3, 4. Testing 1, 2, 3, 4.
The host director for running everything. And Pat Randall is the head of our Office of Communications. So she's responsible for the entire Institute's education, information efforts, media liaison, all of that sort of stuff comes under Pat's area. Again, Tony will be here soon if there are some details on the organization of the Institute and where we fit and all that sort of stuff that we can answer for you, I'd be happy to do so.
No, actually, we've sort of outlined a presentation that we want to do to you, so.
Okay, so we'll,
right.
We'll hang loose until he's here, and I hope he will be here any minute now. And again, he asked me to apologize because things do get stacked up sometimes. And largely has to do with the commitments of a lot of the incoming new staff fellows in the rounds that have been done, because he still, in spite of the fact that he coordinates the AIDS research out of Building 1 and directs this institute, he's still very much committed to his own laboratory research and does, in fact, see patients on rounds twice a week. So I think that's somewhat unusual for institute directors, but I think it's very important, and it will, you know, shows you that he is still very much involved with hands-on dealing with patients, and primarily AIDS patients. And I hear the good timing. I just did a little administrative overview of the Institute. So
you did. Okay.
Different from me, you, and Dan and stuff.
Sounds like an interesting conversation.
Well, it may not have been. It was a few minutes of chattering to sort of fill some space till we get here.
All right.
A few questions that we'd like to...
Ross, okay. What are you doing here?
You're not ACT UP DC.
Well, we're not all ACT UP DC.
Oh,
either.
No, well, that's...
So why don't we start and we'll introduce ourselves,
yourself,
right? Yeah. And you can introduce yourselves again. And we'll get to know each other sooner or later. My name is Maxine Wolf. I'm from ACT UP New York.
I'm Risa Denenberg. I live in New York. I'm with ACT UP New York.
I'm Heidi Doro. I'm with ACT UP New York.
I'm Lori Sprecher. I'm with ACT UP DC.
Linda Meredith, also with ACT UP DC.
Girls,
go.
Melinda Daniels, ACT UP DC.
Well, why
so
don't you
do
that?
So you got three ACT UP DCs and the rest are ACT UP New York.
Yeah. Why don't we do that again? So, because people came in separately, so just let me know.
Can we agree to this? we didn't just
look behind you, can we?
Well, actually, what I'm doing with this is I want to try to get this issue out to our other chapters so they understand these issues, and I think this is a great way to do it.
No, that's all right. We've had things...
If you want to go off the record
no,
at any point, that's fine.
We've had things recorded by ACT UP New York. I don't know yet if I can trust ACT UP DC. I have a long history with ACT UP New York, so that makes me not nervous, but I just need you to know that. The purpose of it is to distribute it to one.
Other chapters, and it may end up, some of it, we're going to try to put something together, and it may go on public television for DC public television.
No. No.
Okay,
no.
Then it'll go to other chapters, and this your piece won't go to DC, won't go to public television.
I would really prefer not, in the past, Tony has agreed to take it.
He's
never had a problem with that. Yeah.
Okay,
I think visual bothers me considerably.
Well, okay, then I won't videotape you people, I'll videotape the activists. Right. Well, actually, the angle would be better over here, but I'll miss you guys.
I thought the most important thing is the substance of the discussion here. What you all want to do is use a tape to take back, so you'll have for your records the kinds of discussion. I don't think this really suits out.
I think that basically what Melinda is saying is that it's important for other people in ACT UP chapters to see, to also hear what we have to say. And that's why she's saying that she can agree not to tape the people from NIAID, but she would like to have that as a real aspect of what we do, because part of this is for those chapters to get the information that we're going to be giving you.
She's just saying where to start. not you.
Right, so if you can agree...
You're going to make a presentation.
Yes.
That's our intention.
You want to take that.
Right.
Not necessarily any response.
Right. That
right.
We're just...
If you want to agree
that
to
we're
that,
just,
then, yeah.
That we're just going to use the tape recorder so that
yeah.
we have, can recall what the conversation was. But for the videotaping, we would like it so that other women who are doing activism can get this information and other ACT UP chapters can get the information that we have. And I think that's fairly fair, since it wouldn't put any of you on that video.
And well,
no, actually, see, the problem is that, as I'm sure the ACT UP New York people know, that I let them do anything when we engage in discussions, but I'm not sure, I have good instinct, and there's something about my instinct that's telling me that this ain't good. And I'm not sure what it is. But
I'm not comfortable.
Yeah.
I don't know you,
okay? And when you're in this business like I am, we get things that get really distorted. They wind up in this and that, and all of a sudden, it doesn't get through to a good person. If we develop a relationship where I know where we're going, then that's okay. So, I mean, I hate to throw water on your...
Would you be more comfortable if she stood behind you so that she could only
film us? I think the only place I'm going to be is the room.
Not her out of the room.
Obviously, I'm referring to what she's carrying with her.
Yeah.
Now, you can override that, but I'm not comfortable.
But let's try to be productive and cooperative about it, and see if we can get your purpose fulfilled without having any real difficulty. The purpose is that you want to in an educational way, get what you're talking about to other
ACT UP chapters,
women right. ACT UP chapters.
Particularly to women. But also to men who are
working
around the country.
There aren't any women ACT UP chapters that I know about.
Particularly
and ACT UP chapters all include women, but ACT UP chapters don't always know about women.
In case
issues.
You don't know, we've just completed a book on women and AIDS, okay, that will be going out. We also know, as people who've been doing organizing, and you should know as people who are interested in educating, that visual material works much better in terms of getting information out quickly.
Now,
people.
Is this a special interest and or mandate of ACT UP DC to do
no,
this?
No, this is a collective decision that we want to have this as part of an informational tape that will go out to ACT UP people. But I think that if you just focus on the fact that the visual here is going to be of us and not of you. Okay, so in terms of your concerns, which are that things could be misused about you, you will not be on this tape, is what we're agreeing to.
Well, yeah, but... What, Karan? Yeah.
I just... I don't like to be in this issue. I mean, I don't think that it's going to be a problem for anybody.
Well, you'd be surprised. You'd be surprised.
Well, what's your concern about us being taped?
It's kind of difficult to...
Or is your assumption that we're going to say that we're doing us and we're going to do you?
No, no, no. It's a question of it's pretty difficult when you're asking, if the answers come out, that it, you have to be a moron not to figure out it's me on the tape.
But when we
well,
talking,
right now, let me just try to explain what we have, how we would like to organize the session.
Yeah.
Okay, we have presentations to make to you,
right.
All of us, okay? And that's going to constitute the first part of this. And then I think we would all agree that that tape would go off after that.
It's not a question.
It's not a question
and
answer type thing.
Oh, that's fine.
We're
going to come
okay.
here and do that. No problem.
Okay. Great.
Now, what's our time frame about this? We had planned an hour. Okay. Okay. So let's go.
Okay.
Let's start.
Well, let me do the introduction. As you realize now, we're members of both ACT UP New York and ACT UP DC, and. What you may not know is that we are women who have been focusing on the issue of women and AIDS for years. Years. We have backgrounds in women's health. We are women who have worked with women with AIDS. We are people who've done research. We are activists. No offense, but we are not impressed by doctors, nor are we impressed by medicine in general. And the reason is that, is because we know that those two groups have never cared about women. And we also know that we know more about women than you do. And we want to make that clear to start with, because I think that it's a way that you have to listen to what we have to say, because we know what we're talking about. The reason that we're here is because having this background and doing this work for years, it's clear to us that neither NIH or NIAID or the Division of AIDS would take any responsibility for women's life if we didn't force you to. And that we're tired of ignorance as a justification for inaction. So what we tried to do in setting up this time with you was to structure this meeting so that we're going to do the following. One is to give you a chronology of how we got in this room today, in case there are some of you who don't know. The second is to tell you some of the things that we think you need to know about women and about women with HIV/AIDS, including the reality of the lives of women who are HIV positive or who have AIDS, why and how women are different physiologically and biologically, despite the remark you made about a year and a half ago at the community center, Dr. Fauci, about how you didn't think there were any differences, how they're also different socially, economically, and politically, and what that means for the ways that NIAID and the Division of AIDS have to approach work on women with HIV infection and AIDS if you're seriously going to do something about it. To use a word, it's got to be a holistic approach. What we're going to do after that is also tell you what we know about your structure and what your responsibilities are and how what we want fits into that. And then we're going to tell you what we want. And we're going to do this one at a time. So we're going to start with Heidi Darrow from New York ACT UP, who's going to give you a brief chronology of how we got here.
Okay. As we all know by now, we're 10 years into this epidemic. And we still have no idea how many women are infected with HIV, how HIV manifests itself in women's bodies, or how to treat those manifestations in those women's bodies. And while the concerns around women with HIV-related disease may be of new interest to you and the rest of the NIH, activists have been fighting for the needs of women in this epidemic for years now. As early as 1987, women in ACT UP New York formed a women's caucus to address the under-enrollment of women in clinical trials. And large, noisy, and effective demonstrations have targeted your floundering ACTG sites at places like NYU and Sloan Kettering. Activists have also targeted other federal agencies responsible for the continued invisibility of women with AIDS. ACT UPs from around the country took on the FDA for, among other things, accepting trial data that does not include information on how experimental treatments affects women's bodies. So we shut down FDA headquarters in Rockville in 1988. We also laid siege to the CDC in Atlanta, which refuses to expand its definition of AIDS to include the opportunistic infections of women or track woman-to-woman transmission of HIV. Further, because there is no comprehensive, understandable, or available information about women and AIDS, activists have been forced to write their own information. Activists wrote their own book about women and AIDS, rather than wait around for you guys to put something out there for us to read. In addition, women have always been given the responsibility for safer sex, and more outrageously, the responsibility for the fallout about misinformation around safe sex. Activists who have challenged bogus claims in publications like Cosmopolitan magazine and the book The Myth of Heterosexual AIDS. We have to spend our precious time planning actions against these blockheads because there has been no concentrated public information campaign or medical research to convey to women that they are at risk. Mr. Hoth, you yourself have not gone unnoticed in our efforts to bring attention to women and AIDS. As a matter of fact, you of all people have the power and the resources to start addressing the needs of women in this crisis, and you have failed to meet that challenge. We sat in your office in May to demand that there be a Women and AIDS Committee. We got no response from you. ACT UP DC sent you a letter asking for a meeting about women and AIDS. No response. You were zapped in San Francisco in front of 5,000 colleagues at the International AIDS Conference. No response. Finally, ACT UP DC gave you a call at your office and asked when we were going to have that meeting, and they basically strong-armed you into giving us a date. That's why we're here. It's the only reason we're here. It's clear that you and the rest of your pals here at the NIH are not interested in the lives of women. You have not shown us one ounce of action that would prove that otherwise. You obviously don't respond to the increasing number of dead women. What you do seem to respond to, however, is pressure. Arm twisting, yelling, screaming, embarrassment, bodies in your office, marches, disruptions, activists in your face. You can meet us across the conference table, or you can meet us on the street and at your door. The choice is yours, because we're not going anywhere.
The next thing that we want to deal with is, given that context, what is the reality for women with AIDS as we see it? And Lori Sprecher is going to start that off. From DC ACT UP.
It was recently brought to your attention in a GAO study that no drug trials have ever adequately studied the effects of drugs on women's bodies before these drugs are released for public consumption. The two working assumptions here are that one, women are not part of the general population which needs medication, and two, women's bodies are not in any way markedly different from men's bodies, so there's no need to study them specifically. Both assumptions are, of course, false. The lack of medical and scientific attention paid to women is a pervasive and persistent problem, which leads to grossly negligent medical practices. Because drugs are never sufficiently tested on women before their release, women end up taking drugs which might not be suitable for them, taking suitable drugs at the wrong dose, or not being introduced to drugs which might benefit them. The whole extent of disease in women is distorted and underrepresented within the context of a system which devalues us. The fact that women are not studied as women means that there is no adequate data about women and no adequate health care for women. Women and women's specific health care needs have never been valued, validated, or met by the medical establishment. This is what's true, and now we have AIDS, and what has always been true provides the climate for this current disaster, which is women and AIDS. The invisibility of women and lesbians is a result of a system designed not to include us in the first place. And this is why it has taken us so long to even notice that, yes, in fact, women are getting AIDS. And had we applied what we knew about HIV to women all along as we were learning it, collected data as though women mattered, provided non-biased preventative information, included women in experimental treatments, or even given women access to the most basic health care, the statistics on women and AIDS would look a lot different. Now women are the fastest growing group to get AIDS. The number of women with AIDS increased 45% in the last year. Women account for 22% of people with AIDS in Newark, 20% in Puerto Rico, 13% in New York City, and 19% of all newly diagnosed cases of people with AIDS are women. most women aren't even being diagnosed because no one has been paying attention to the pattern of opportunistic infections women get. And even if women are properly diagnosed, they are still dying at a rate 6 times faster than HIV-positive men. Women have the highest rate of unaccounted for transmission. In 9% of all women diagnosed with AIDS, as compared to 3% in men, we do not know how transmission occurred. What do we know, for example, about woman-to-woman transmission? It's a mystery. And it has always been a cliché to talk about the mystery of women, but it's stupid to hang on to that within a medical establishment supposedly designed to treat real illnesses in real women's bodies. Women have always received a kind of health care in translation. They get a hand-me-down system which is really designed to treat men and to service the male body. They are punished for being different, for having different needs, for allowing illness to manifest itself differently in their bodies. I realize the medical establishment's agenda for creating a profitable situation around AIDS, and that women don't earn as much as men, and lesbians have even less access to economic resources. But I'm here because I live in my body, and so does every woman I know, and we will not be devalued, and you will see us.
In order to talk about what are the different manifestations of HIV and AIDS for women and how that relates to women's physiology and the differences between women and men, Lisa Denenberg is going to give us a review of some of that information.
It's clear that not enough is known about women and HIV disease. There's no research being done. Data is not being collected. There's no excuse for the neglect, but it's now resulting in dire survival times and increased rates of HIV infection in women. But even though it's not possible to draw firm conclusions about risk factors in women, disease progression, opportunistic infections, or proper treatments, we also have a responsibility to act now on what we do know. And we do know some things. Despite protestations to the contrary, women's bodies are different than men. And women get sick differently from men. And women live in a context that's different than the context that men live in. And HIV does affect women's bodies differently. Women's bodies are viewed in a context that reflects sexist institutions. Women are dying faster than men. To me, that proves that something is wrong. Something's being done wrong. It occurs for a variety of complex reasons. Diagnosis often comes late in the course of a woman's illness. Or women die without a diagnosis of AIDS. Women die of ARC. That has to be wrong. Women are grossly underdiagnosed altogether, and women are certainly misdiagnosed, where AIDS is not the cause of death, even though they're dead, and they're probably HIV positive had they ever been tested. And in addition to that, women's symptoms that sound the same if they're addressed, like weight loss or fatigue, are viewed differently when a woman says she's tired than when a man says he's tired, when a woman has lost weight than when a man says he has lost weight. Women are different. Women are subject to unique organ-specific diseases such as pelvic inflammatory disease, cervical cancer, and vaginal candidiasis. These things don't happen to men. Women have an increased rate of certain diseases such as breast cancer and urinary tract infections. And women have an increased likelihood of suffering more serious consequences from diseases that equally affect men and women. Example, chlamydia. Women also die and have morbidity from complications of pregnancy. That doesn't happen to men. And it's been said, and I think it's been studied, that women IVDUs have more medical problems than male IVDUs. Women with HIV disease are greater than 70% people of color. Women with HIV disease are poorer than men, and they're more likely to be IVDUs. Thus, women with HIV have a greater incidence of tuberculosis, respiratory infections, pneumonia, endocarditis, renal and liver disease. A critical point, however, in the discussion of women and HIV is the reality that HIV-positive women generally present with gynecological problems which don't respond to usual treatments such as yeast infections, pelvic infections, herpes, warts, etc. Most of the time, these things are not picked up with any clue that the woman might be HIV-positive. I personally know that women's GYN needs are not being met by people who are supposedly experts in the field of HIV infection, and I work in New York City. And New York City people are supposed to know. I volunteer at a community clinic where I'm seeing an increasing number of HIV-positive women for GYN care who are fully enrolled in qualified IDC programs who are not even getting an annual pap smear. or her given a prescription for vaginal creams for their complaint of vaginal discharge without getting a gynecological exam, without getting a pelvic exam. That's happening in New York City. I can't even imagine what's happening anywhere else. We have some research. I don't know if you've looked at the research or not. I've looked at the research. I think that the research is not adequate to make broad decisions, but I think that we could be doing a lot with the little research that does exist. I can't talk about all the areas that I think need to be researched, but I will discuss several. Most importantly, women with HIV disease have a tremendously high rate of abnormal pap smears. They have an increased rate of cervical intraepithelial neoplasia. They have a greater rate of cervical cancer. They have much more HPV disease than other women who are having some of the same characteristics, and unusual vaginal neoplasias. And some of the research on this, I'll quote you if you're not familiar with it, because some of this has even been placed into the concept of what we should be doing. Schrager, whose name apparently is associated with NIAID, has said that careful and frequent pelvic exams and cervicovaginal smears are indicated in women with HIV disease. People in New York don't seem to know this. Marte, in 1989, found that 50% of PAPs were abnormal in this population. We also know that back before HIV was studied well, that there was a great relationship between HPV disease and intraepithelial neoplasia in immunosuppressed women. The women in studies like that were women undergoing renal transplant who were immunocompromised. And we know that HPV disease is associated with a higher rate of PAPs and with a higher rate of cervical cancer. Prevention in 88 described a strong association between HIV and abnormal PAPs, recommended close PAP screening, aggressive care for cervical cancer. Monfardini in 89 described cervical cancer in HIV-positive women in a program, and the majority of those women were not diagnosed with AIDS, but they had aggressive, some of them had very aggressive cervical cancer, and some of the cancer did not respond to usual treatment. Barron in 89 describes a high risk of, in HIV-positive women of having HPV. And, of course, a lot of women have HPV, cervical HPV. But in these women, it was often widespread throughout the lower genital tract, which is more unusual. Second area of concern is vaginal candidiasis, the real yeast infection. I think probably the women at the table have all had one. But it's different in women with AIDS. Because it presents as a precursor to more serious indicators of immunocompromise. It was described by Rhodes in 87 and Marte again in 89 and several other people. I don't have all of the quotes on this. I think this is common knowledge now, that vaginal candidiasis precedes oral thrush in HIV-positive women. That 67% of HIV-positive women in a study at Brown University Medical Center had severe recurrent vaginal candidal infections that did not respond to usual treatment prior to any sign of other immune dysfunction. And I did see a study that was interesting of an what would be an experimental drug here in this country for treating vaginal candidiasis, fluconazole. But it was studied in Britain on women who were not immunocompromised. I'm not sure why they wanted to do this study, but they were studying a comparison of single-dose fluconazole with intravaginal cream or tablets and in the treatment of vaginal candidiasis, which they found to be a superior treatment. But I certainly don't know of any protocols for using fluconazole in treating vaginal candidiasis in this country. A third area is pelvic inflammatory disease, which of course can lead to tubal ovarian abscesses and the need for surgery in a lot of women. I read a lot about the increased rate of PID in adolescents, something that we should all be aware of and alarmed about. Dr. Cohen, who's with Cook County in Chicago, by phone conversation has talked about a very high rate of tubal ovarian abscesses in her HIV-positive clients, and I've heard this anecdotally from a lot of people. And Saffron, 1990, another source, describing acute PID, which is associated with an increased incidence of HIV. He was studying sequentially women who presented with acute PID. And the rate of HIV in that group was 6.7%, which, as you know, is quite high. But it was 23 times higher in women in that group who were IVDUs. Other things that have been suggested just by reading about women and AIDS, which you obviously can't do by plugging women and AIDS into any computer, but if you do research the topic, you'll find that there are questions raised about rates of chlamydia, increased rates of chlamydia in women who are being followed, there's certainly questions about how chancroid presents in women and whether it should be, is observed exactly the same way that it is observed in men. Gardnerella is a non-serious pathogen in normal women. I'm not sure whether or not it presents differently in women with HIV, but I've seen some suggestion that it might. There's one letter out there about CMV, cervical CMV in a patient. And, of course, there's incidental reports about PID associated with odd organisms like tuberculosis and other opportunistic pathogens that are really hard to pin down, but certainly need to be known about. It seems that immediately, actually seems like a long time ago, we should have been looking at some things that this information suggests. And this is, to me, very much the tip of the iceberg. We need to look at treatment and prophylaxis protocols for vaginal candidiasis. People in the field are doing things about vaginal candidiasis because it's not responding.
And so we're having to do different things. So some protocols exist out there. Some of these protocols are not standard treatments. Some of these protocols use home remedies and use things that Western medicine isn't using because they seem to work. Some of these things aren't working. We need to use some experimental drugs also and plan some studies to study how we can suppress and prevent recurrent vaginal candidiasis in women who are HIV positive. Certainly we need to do that. We need to also look at treatment and prophylaxis protocols, regimens for PID and HIV positive women. I do not believe that they are likely to turn out to be, likely that it turns out to be just fine to use the old standard routines, because it's not working, because these women are developing two ovarian abscesses, and some of them are dying of that. And when they die of that, they're not dying of AIDS, because they don't get a diagnosis. And that should be studied retrospectively by looking at death certificates, perhaps of IVDUs. We need some prevalence studies of coexisting pathogens that seem to be very prevalent in women with HIV, that include HPV, chlamydia, CMV, chancroid, other things that we could talk about. And we certainly need prospective longitudinal studies of women with abnormal pap smears, CIN, and cervical cancer to see what's happening to them, whether the cancers are more aggressive, and whether they respond to usual treatments, which in some cases apparently they do not.
In addition to obvious different physiological and biological differences that are creating different patterns in women with AIDS and suggest different research questions than the ones people have been focusing on, there are ways in which women differ from men in the social and economic and political context in which they exist that's very relevant to the way research is planned. And Linda Meredith is going to talk about that.
Yeah, first I wanted to talk about a couple of reasons why women either choose not to access a medical system or are denied access to that. Obviously, they might be denied access to a medical system simply because of economic reasons. Unfortunately, it runs much deeper than that, because women, in some cases, choose not to access a system where we have been handed things that were invasive to our bodies, such as radical mastectomies, total hysterectomies, coercive counseling rather than informed choice. Those are all the norm for women of low socioeconomic class and perhaps for women of color. In addition, lesbians face other barriers to the coverage and to a healthcare system, and let me just tell you what they are. First, we have less frequent gynecological exams because we don't have birth control. We do not need contraceptives. We do not present ourselves to OBGYN people in a lot of cases, because to do that would mean that we have to confront their homophobia. Because you see, when they start to ask me about what kind of birth control I'm on, I tell them I don't need birth control, and they continue to pressure me about why. I have to tell them I'm a lesbian. That's met with a lot of resistance. Women don't want to hear that. Also, to avoid homophobia in the workplace, lesbians typically choose like less traditional kinds of employment, which means that they don't have access to health care that's normally in the context of a corporation, or those lesbians may be self-employed in order to avoid homophobia.
Also, low-income lesbians who do not have children may not be covered by Medicaid, because a lot of times you have to have children. Access to that program is tied to the Aid to Families with Dependent Children program. So those are just some of the reasons why we choose not to, or we denied access to health care. I want to spend a little bit of time talking about how the CDC definition and the CDC's epidemiology is set up to exclude women and kill them, because Dr. Hope, you announced at the ACTG meeting about a joint conference between NIAID and the CDC focusing on women's issues. I thought it might be good to just talk about what we know about the CDC. First of all, you have to access a CDC-defined diagnosis to be able to get Medicaid, Medicare, SSI, a host of benefits that can either prolong your life or increase the quality of your life if you have AIDS. Women frequently don't get that diagnosis, and then they're denied access because the definition of the OIs that are included in the CDC-defined diagnosis were typically defined in male patients. Women's first symptoms are frequently gynecological. It's really common for women with HIV to have chronic candida yeast infection in the vagina, and the mouth version of candidiasis is the only one that's on the CDC definition. I was really horrified to find when I went to the ACTG meeting that there was a session on the use of fluconazole in oral candidiasis. There was no mention of vaginal candidiasis at that session. In addition to their restrictive definition of AIDS, their research into the epidemiology of infection dismisses the importance of information on the research into women. Researchers from the University of California in San Francisco have documented the fact that for every heterosexual AIDS transmission from an infected woman to a man, there are 12 heterosexual transmissions from an infected man to a woman. It's unclear what biological or social mechanisms are at work here. The CDC has also refused to investigate the probability of woman-to-woman transmission. There was a paper presented in Montreal by Denise Ribble, which stated that 10% of the women that she studied had documented HIV as a result of woman-to-woman transmission. How can we create safer sex information for women in general and for lesbians in particular when people aren't even telling us how women get AIDS? Women with HIV live in fear of a legal, medical, and social service system which offers punishment for instead of assistance with the special problems that they face. At the ACTG meeting, one of the site coordinators in Worcester, Mass., told me of three women who were enrolled in the ACTU in Worcester who lost custody of their children because their anonymity had been compromised about their disease state by accessing the ACTU. Word like that spreads. Women don't want to lose their children. In addition to that, women's lives focus around survival. They focus around issues such as buying food, paying rent, taking care of their children who oftentimes are also sick, many of them with HIV. Their priorities do not include taking care of themselves in a health care perspective, because they're trying to keep their head above water on a daily basis. I want to talk a little bit about women in the context of the ACTG trials. First of all, we've looked at the data, and we know that only 5% of all the people in clinical trials are women. Now, I saw a recent report of May 1990 from NIAID that said that 11% were women. What we then did was try to figure out why my number was discrepant from yours. And the reason that we finally figured out was because there are children, female children, and pregnant women that account for some of those numbers. The way in which current clinical trials are done on pregnant women has no bearing on their treatment or health care, because those trials are simply focused on the outcome of the newborn. An ACTG site coordinator in the Bronx at the meeting told me that the question that you have to ask women about whether or not you're on birth control is very loosely interpreted at the Bronx site. So, because they care enough to incorporate women into their clinical trial. But the site coordinator in New Orleans told me that they use a very rigid definition of what constitutes adequate or appropriate birth control, and it excludes a lot of women. The New Orleans site coordinator also told me that they require IVDUs to be currently in a drug treatment program before they're allowed to access an ACTU. That philosophy presumes two things. First of all, that there are enough treatment programs to go around, and that's not true. The second thing is that it presumes that IVDUs who aren't in a treatment program are irresponsible. And I know that that's also not true, because there are needle exchange programs all over this country, primarily some that have been set up by ACTA. IVDUs come to those places on a regular basis because they know they can get clean needles, and they voluntarily dispose of their dirty ones. That does not sound to me like irresponsible death wishes, That sounds to me like people who are trying to save their lives. Also, I'm told that baseline levels for liver function enzymes as entry criteria for some of the trials are set up because some of these drugs that you're testing are very toxic. Well, I want to know for sure if that's true, because what we know is that IVDUs have elevated levels of liver enzyme and they're automatically excluded. Since 52% of women with AIDS are IVDU, we need to look at that criteria and question whether or not it's valid. In addition, some of the way that the protocols are written in terms of timing for blood collections during the pharmacokinetic studies are perhaps unnecessarily rigid. I don't know, but you need to address it. Women who perhaps have to, like, go to the hospital because their child is in intensive care, but they're also on a study, and they miss their 48-hour blood sample, are ejected from a protocol. Does that just mean some scientists made it up because they want pure data, or is it a real thing? If the answer is it's a real thing, it's a real thing. I don't think it is. I think people aren't including the concept of women's lives in the structuring and the development of the protocols. It has occurred to us that if, you know, the grant proposals that you sent out give credence to things like computers or libraries or fluorescent activated cell sorters, why couldn't they also demand primary care, routine gynecological exams, child care, transportation? Seems just as easy to require those in a grant proposal as it does to require those other things. Finally, I want to talk about the way that women do or do not get safer sex education. There was a study that was done at Johns Hopkins, which basically said that women don't get it, that they're at risk. 40% of the women that are now infected do not have any clue that they engaged in any kind of high-risk behavior. That tells me that safe sex is not reaching women in a real way, in an understandable way, in a way that can affect long-term behavioral changes. Here are two things that bother me. First of all, the way in which safer sex education is presented to women sends a clear message of blame and guilt. At the conference in San Francisco, there was a variety of papers that were presented on the decrease in HIV among women who use condoms. And I don't know, but the last time I checked, a condom fits on a penis. The second part of it that bugs me is the following, the whole context of vertical transmission, which really blames women for infecting a child, and no one talks about the horizontal transmission that occurred at the time of conception. So these are the things that disturb me about safer sex messages and the way that women are still sent messages of guilt. Also, I want to talk just for 1 second about the way that lesbians have had to try to get information out about protecting themselves. Mostly that has been done by activist groups. In particular, I think ACT UP New York and ACT UP San Francisco and other women have educated themselves about how lesbians might choose to protect themselves from this virus. Government disinterest, lesbian invisibility, and denial all tell us that lesbians are not at risk. But I know that that's not true. Because what I know about lesbians is that they share needles, that they sleep with men, that they engage in sexual behavior that might result in bleeding and trauma. And if you think about that in the context of what puts people at risk, then that means lesbians are at risk. I guess the last thing I wanted to say is that it occurred to me that what happens with women in AIDS is that they just have run out of choices. There are no choices. That's oppression. And in this case, that oppression is killing women with AIDS.
Okay, Bronze wants to address some ways in which the responsibilities of NIAID, NIH, and the Division of AIDS fit into some of the things that we've mentioned. And then I just want to end by doing a set of what we think needs to be done. Okay,
let me just mention that, unfortunately, the presentations have gone now 40 minutes, and we have an hour, so you may present and not hear anything. That's
fine. We think that you have to hear what we have to say first.
I'm pleased to hear it.
Okay. Go ahead, Ron.
Okay, I'll just be brief then. The bottom line for us really is, what are the effects of everything that the NIAID is doing in real women's lives now? And at this point, a lot has been changing within the NIAID and within NIH. But so far, it's at the point of tolerance.